I think a lot of people would observe that we are right now living in an Ayn Rand novel, metaphorically speaking.
It's this Ayn Rand stuff from Atlas Shrugged and from The Fountainhead about how important it is to take care of the rich.
Ayn Rand's philosophy of selfishness and billionaire empowerment rules the world. And today, the United States and other independent governments around the world are crumbling while Ayn Rand's billionaires are taking over.
This is a real philosophy. It is a fringe one, but it is a real philosophy.
Rand, whose doctrine states self-sacrifice for one's friends, a core tenet of Christianity, is akin to slavery, teaches the value of the self over all others. In her worldview, self-interest and greed take the place of a higher power.
In her mind, she divided the world into makers and takers. On one side are the billionaires and the industrialists, people like Dagny Taggart, a railroad tycoon, and Hank Reardon, a steel magnate. Both were fictional characters in her book Atlas Shrugged, but both have real-world counterparts in the form of the Koch brothers.
That's right. Ayn Rand worshipped greed and denied the existence of God.
So in Atlas Shrugged, when the billionaires, tired of paying taxes and complying with government regulation, when those billionaires went on strike, Ayn Rand wrote that the American economy promptly collapsed.
So there's a rally. He's not just a middle-of-the-road guy who wants to make the tough decisions. No. He's a guy that wants to help out the winners in society and make it a little rough for people who are riding along depending on the government. He doesn't like those people, especially. I think he's Ayn Rand, and I think if you study...
Oh, my God!
Between stupidity like this and the rebirth of Ayn Rand through corporate-funded think tanks and Hollywood movies, the billionaire class wants to make sure that the next generation buys into a toxic ideology that's quite literally destroying the world as we know it.
And so tonight, the Ayn Rand case is closed.
"Ladies and gentlemen," said a voice that came from the radio receiver. A man's clear, calm, implacable voice. The kind of voice that had not been heard on the airwaves for years. "Mr. Thompson will not speak to you tonight. His time is up. I have taken it over. You were to hear a report on the world crisis. That is what you are going to hear." Three gasps of recognition greeted the voice, but nobody had the power to notice them among the sounds of the crowd, which were beyond the stage of cries. One was a gasp of triumph, another of terror, the third of bewilderment. Three persons had recognized the speaker: Dagny, Dr. Stadler, Eddie Willis. Nobody glanced at Eddie Willers, but Dagny and Dr. Stadler glanced at each other. She saw that his face was distorted by as evil a terror as one could ever bear to see. He saw that she knew, and that the way she looked at him was as if the speaker had slapped his face. "For 12 years you have been asking, 'Who is John Galt?' This is John Galt speaking. I am the man who loves his life. I am the man who does not sacrifice his love or his values. I am the man who has deprived you of victims and thus has destroyed your work. And if you wish to know why you are perishing, you who dread knowledge, I am the man who will now tell you." The chief engineer was the only one able to move. He ran to a television set and struggled frantically with its dials. But the screen remained empty. The speaker had not chosen to be seen. Only his voice filled the airways of the country. "Of the world," thought the chief engineer, sounding as if he were speaking here in this room. Not to a group, but to one man. It was not the tone of addressing a meeting, but the tone of addressing a mob. "You have heard it said that this is an age of moral crisis. You have said it yourself, half in fear, half in hope that the words had no meaning. You have cried that man's sins are destroying the world, and you have cursed human nature for its unwillingness to practice the virtues you demand. Since virtue, to you, consists of sacrifice, you have demanded more sacrifices at every successive disaster. In the name of a return to morality, you have sacrificed all those evils which you held as the cause of your plight. You have sacrificed justice to mercy. You have sacrificed independence to unity. You have sacrificed reason to faith. You have sacrificed wealth to need. You have sacrificed self-esteem to self-denial. You have sacrificed happiness to duty. You have destroyed all that which you held to be evil and achieved all that which you held to be good. Why then do you shrink in horror from the sight of the world around you? That world is not the product of your sins. It is the product and the image of your virtues. It is your moral ideal brought into reality in its full and final perfection. You have fought for it. You have dreamed of it. You have wished it. And I am the man who has granted you your wish. Your ideal had an implacable enemy, which your code of morality was designed to destroy. I have withdrawn that enemy. I have taken it out of your way and out of your reach. I have removed the source of all those evils you were sacrificing one by one. I have ended your battle. I have stopped your motive. I have deprived your world of man's mind. Men do not live by the mind, you say? I have withdrawn those who do. The mind is impotent, you say? I have withdrawn those whose mind isn't. There are values higher than the mind, you say? I have withdrawn those for whom there are. While you were dragging to your sacrificial altars the men of justice, of independence, of reason, of wealth, of self-esteem, I beat you to it. I reached them first. I told them the nature of the game you were playing and the nature of that moral code of yours, which they had been too innocently generous to grasp. I showed them the way to live by another morality, mine. It is mine that they chose to follow. All the men who have vanished, the men you hated, yet dreaded to lose, it is I who have taken them away from you. Do not attempt to find us. We do not choose to be found. Do not cry that it is our duty to serve you. We do not recognize such duty. Do not cry that you need us. We do not consider need a claim. Do not cry that you own us. You don't. Do not beg us to return. We are on strike. We, the men of the mind. We are on strike against self-immolation. We are on strike against the creed of unearned rewards and unrewarded duties. We are on strike against the dogma that the pursuit of one's happiness is evil. We are on strike against the doctrine that life is guilt. There is a difference between our strike and all those you've practiced for centuries. Our strike consists not of making demands, but of granting. We are evil, according to your morality. We have chosen not to harm you any longer. We are useless, according to your economics. We have chosen not to exploit you any longer. We are dangerous and to be shackled, according to your politics. We have chosen not to endanger you, nor to wear the shackles any longer. We are only an illusion, according to your philosophy. We have chosen not to blind you any longer and have left you free to face reality. The reality you wanted. The world as you see it now. A world without mind. We have granted you everything you demanded of us. We who had always been the givers, but have only now understood. We have no demands to present to you. No terms to bargain about, no compromise to reach. You have nothing to offer us. We do not need you. Are you now crying, no, this was not what you wanted? A mindless world of ruins was not your goal? You did not want us to leave you? You moral cannibals. I know that you've always known what it was that you wanted, but your game is up, because now we know it too. Through centuries of scourges and disasters, brought about by your code of morality, you have cried that your code had been broken, that the scourges were punishment for breaking, that men were too weak and too selfish to spill all the blood it required. You damned man. You damned existence. You damned this earth, but never dared to question your code. Your victims took the blame and struggled on, with your curses as reward for their martyrdom, while you went on crying that your code was noble, but human nature was not good enough to practice it, and no one rose to ask the question, good? By what standard? You wanted to know John Galt's identity. I am the man who has asked that question. Yes, this is an age of moral crisis. Yes, you are bearing punishment for your evil. But it is not man who is now on trial. And it is not human nature that will take the blame. It is your moral code that's through this time. Your moral code has reached its climax. The blind alley at the end of its course. And if you wish to go on living, what you now need is not to return to morality, you who have never known any, but to discover it. You have heard no concepts of morality but the mystical or the social. You have been taught that morality is a code of behavior imposed on you by whim, the whim of a supernatural power, or the whim of society, to serve God's purpose or your neighbor's welfare, to please an authority beyond the grave or else next door, but not to serve your life or pleasure. Your pleasure, you have been taught, is to be found in immorality. Your interests would best be served by evil, and any moral code must be designed not for you, but against you, not to further your life, but to drain. For centuries, the battle of morality was fought between those who claimed that your life belongs to God and those who claimed that it belongs to your neighbors, between those who preached that the good is self-sacrifice for the sake of ghosts in heaven, and those who preached that the good is self-sacrifice for the sake of incompetence on earth. And no one came to say that your life belongs to you, and that the good is to live it. Both sides agree that morality demands the surrender of your self-interest and of your mind, that the moral and the practical are opposites, that morality is not the province of reason, but the province of faith and force. Both sides agree that no rational morality is possible, that there is no right or wrong in reason, that in reason there's no reason to be moral. Whatever else they fought about, it was against man's mind that all your moralists have stood united. It was man's mind that all their schemes and systems were intended to despoil and destroy. Now, choose to perish, or to learn that the anti-mind is the anti-life.
While it is easy enough to recognize at a common sense level the relationship between self-esteem and integrity, the issue of living up to our standards is not always simple. What if our standards are irrational or mistaken? We may accept or absorb a code of values that does violence to our nature and needs. For example, certain religious teachings implicitly or explicitly damn sex, damn pleasure, damn the body, damn ambition, damn material success, damn, for all practical purposes, the enjoyment of life on earth. If children are indoctrinated with these teachings, what will the practice of integrity mean in their lives? Some elements of quote-unquote hypocrisy may be all that keeps them alive. Once we see that living up to our standards appears to be leading us toward self-destruction, the time has come to question our standards rather than simply resigning ourselves to living without integrity. We must summon the courage to challenge some of our deepest assumptions concerning what we have been taught to regard as the good. One area in which integrity and living consciously clearly intersect is in the need to reflect on the values we have been taught, the shared assumptions of our family or culture, and the roles we may have been assigned. We need to question whether they fit our own perceptions and understanding, or whether they do violence to the deepest and best within us, to what is sometimes called our true nature. One of the penalties for living unconsciously is that of enduring unrewarding lives in the service of self-stultifying ends never examined or not chosen with awareness by the individuals involved. The higher the level of consciousness at which we operate, the more we live by explicit choice, and the more naturally does integrity follow as a consequence.
All right, Wes, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brett. Good to be back.
Yeah, we were talking before, and it looks like we still have some more work to do in this series because all of the things that we've covered so far relate to the internal factors of this pursuit and this understanding. Mm-hmm. We decided that it's probably also going to be worth devoting a couple of shows to the external factors, school, society, etc. So
yeah.
There's more to come.
Yeah, this is actually about the halfway point in the book, so he spends quite a bit of time detailing the effects, the dynamics of self-esteem in the culture. And, of course, this pillar is called the practice of personal integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that he uses the word personal there. I guess integrity can apply to other things. Maybe we'll get into that as we go into the culture and how that impinges upon self-esteem. It's an interesting subject, and it's one that we're all familiar with being freedom lovers, right?
Yeah, yeah, and there's a certain amount of challenge here, too. I mean, the basic idea, the quickest way that he's able to sum it up in the chapter is when words and behaviors match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he goes on to say, integrity is the integration of ideals, convictions, standards, beliefs, and behavior. When our behavior is congruent with our professed values, when ideals and practice match, we have integrity. This is not, I think what's one of the really important things to stress here is it's not something that we're showing off to other people, right? If we don't do these things, we kind of lose face in our own eyes, as he puts it.
Yes. Yes, he has a section about when we betray our own standards. And he has a phrase, one of the great self-deceptions is to tell oneself, only I will know.
Yeah.
So somehow the implication is that my judgment is unimportant and that only the judgment of others counts.
Yeah, but it's really, when it comes to self-esteem, it's really ours that counts the most, or we lose face in our own eyes. And one of the things that I've really tried to stress on the show for years is that, you know, freedom is personal first. So it doesn't really matter what we project out or we try to focus our attention or our resources or our efforts on if it's far away from us. If things aren't okay at home, you know, then what's the point? What's the point of pursuing political liberty or social liberties? I mean, we want to be free ourselves, I think, first and foremost.
Yes. Yeah, that freedom is both personal and political, obviously, that we want. And it's hard to sometimes maintain integrity in a culture of enslavement, essentially, politically, because we have these ideals, the non-aggression principle, for instance, and how does that fit into our lives as we navigate through this economy that is so filled with statism, filled with coercion at every turn, practically, where there's a law and regulation about anything that happens in the economy. So this quest, this practice of personal integrity really comes up against a lot of the cultural stuff. And we've noted that on all these previous pillars as well. All these things interplay with self-esteem practices. And the key, I think, is to keep focused on your own sense of what you believe is going to be most helpful for you and helpful for others in terms of meeting needs. Brandon frames it in terms of what is appropriate, what is proper, what we believe, what we profess about things, and then how we live up to or don't live up to that. So I think an important element in this, and he sketches it out pretty much, the nature of kind of a restorative process and talking about the guilt, right, that we may feel if we don't live up to our standards, you know, how we actually approach the restoration of it or the redemption, if you will, you know, because when we have crazy cultural ideas like original sin, or we're guilty at the outset and condemned that way just by our nature, supposedly, then how do you actually construct a theory of redemption or of restoration in that? You know, you really can't, because you're being undermined by the belief itself that you're flawed, that you're unable to actually do the right thing, quote unquote.
Yeah, and obviously it's worth pointing out, I think it's obvious for most people, but original sin is a concept that extends beyond religion. The idea or the result of the belief in original sin is we need God to make us good. Well, at least for the last 100 or so years in this country alone, and this is true all over the world, but it's really accelerated thanks to some ideologies that have taken hold in America, especially in the 20th century, we need government to make us good. And I used to be a history teacher, and the story that repeats all through these books is chapter after chapter, once upon a time, people had too much freedom and not enough government. But then the government realized that there wasn't enough government and made more government and took a little freedom, and then everything was better the end of the chapter. And that's a recurring theme. I'm not saying that every chapter follows that format, but there's for somebody who cares about personal liberty, there's a little bit too much of that being taught to the young folks for my comfort.
Indeed.
And it has results.
Yeah. And government is this sort of just really vague abstraction, collectivistic abstraction. It really reduces mm-hmm. down to individuals, you know, people that call themselves government or people that call people in government government. You know, it's the organization itself, the institution that uses power over tactics to get people to do things. Otherwise, what would happen without these individuals using the power over tactics? They believe, and many people in the population, most people probably believe that without this group of individuals doing this, then there'd be mayhem, there'd be disorder, there'd be chaos, and dare we say anarchy, which is, you know, connoted with chaos and disorder and so forth, and non-self-responsibility behavior, shall we say. So that is a big fear, and I think the construct of government is really symbolic of the family construct of, you know, stern disciplinarian mother and father, you know, that are going to keep these kids in line lest they just go crazy, you know, they conform to their nature and go out of control and, you know, just do things that are really harmful to themselves and other people and to property. So I think that the government obviously is a manifestation of this authoritarianism in the family, the power over strategies that are used based on a lack of trust and a fear in others. And this, of course, can undermine our own sense of our own standards, you know, because we're told that we're supposed to obey the standards set by others. And oftentimes we see, I mean, children are really adept at seeing the hypocrisy, the inconsistencies in the practice of the standards. Like Brandon says here, if I give sermons on honesty to my children, yet lie to my friends and neighbors, if I become righteous and indignant when people do not keep their commitments to me, but disregard my commitments to others, if I preach a concern with quality, but indifferently sell my customers shoddy goods, if I unload bonds I know to be falling in value to a client who trusts my honor, if I pretend to care about my staff's ideas when my mind is already made up, if I outmaneuver a colleague in the office and appropriate her achievements, if I ask for honest feedback and penalize the employee who disagrees with me, if I ask for pay sacrifices from others on the grounds of hard times and then give myself a gigantic bonus, I may evade my hypocrisy, I may produce any number of rationalizations, but the fact remains, I launch an assault on my self-respect that no rationalization will dispel.
Mm-hmm. Now, it reminded me, too, of you know, the impact that kids, young people, you know, whether we're talking about little kids or even teenagers, are aware of these kinds of hypocrisy in different ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
The of superiors and authority figures,
yes,
who become untrustworthy because of their incongruence. When the very young children ask the questions, why? Why do you smoke? You know, I mean, things like that. Why is it bad for me if you can do it? You know, and
yes.
Obviously,
the timeless do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. And Steph's pointed this out a lot in, you know, the school, like, you know, don't bully, you know, don't use force against other people. You kids, you follow these rules, but we'll force other people to pay our salaries.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. When you start really being able to ask those questions, the incongruence in the world all around us becomes incredibly troubling. But I also think about just the negative emotional and psychological effects that this has on young people. I mean, I've been an adult with an inconsistent boss, and that was stressful enough.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is a place where I could have packed up my little, you know, lunch tote bag and walked out of there.
Mm-hmm.
if I wanted to, if things got bad enough. But kids in school, kids at home, they don't have that option. And it's also especially troubling that they're aware of this inconsistency, this hypocrisy, this incongruence. And that makes life difficult, I think, for almost all of us growing up, because we might not be able to identify, you know, what's so troubling about it. But I could remember feeling it. And I remember, you know, how defective I felt, not knowing that it was school that sucked and school that was corrupt and school that was not about education and not about accurately measuring how smart or capable I was. And, you know, not knowing how corrupt and just irrational and really violent government was, and not knowing that religion wasn't some kind of divine absolute truth. That produces a real sense of defectiveness in young people. And those things are never pointed out to them.
No.
You know, that, yo, all these things are bullshit. So don't worry about people trying to use their supposed virtue to make you feel bad, because that's nonsense.
Yeah, it's incredibly dismaying when you think about all the systemic factors that lead us down paths of self-estrangement, of our own standards, our own sense of, you know, what is going to be respectful for ourselves and respectful for other people. And, you know, Brandon says, to understand the lapses of integrity that are detrimental to self-esteem, consider what a lapse of integrity entails. If I act in contradiction to a moral value held by someone else, but not by me, I may or may not be wrong, but I cannot be faulted for having betrayed my convictions. If, however, I act against what I myself regard as right, if my actions clash with my expressed values, then I act against my judgment. I betray my mind. Hypocrisy, by its very nature, is self-invalidating. It is mind rejection itself, or mind rejecting itself. A default on integrity undermines me and contaminates my sense of self. It damages me as no external rebuke or rejection can damage me. And I think that is often overlooked, that psychological insight in how we deal with ourselves, because it's somewhat easy. Like I said, children notice it readily, the inconsistencies and the double standards that are going on. But trying to make sense of them from the external point of view is very difficult. If we look inside the psyche and see the damage that's going on in terms of the defense mechanisms that need to be erected to keep a stable sense of self, I mean, that is really the crux of the matter, that we're actually becoming more and more distanced from our true selves, if you will, our ability to actually make sense of things and to be helpful for ourselves, helpful guides for ourselves and for others, and to relate to everybody in a way that is win-win rather than, you know, win-lose, typically what we see with systems, especially in schools and religion and oftentimes in parenting and definitely with statism. So, yeah, how to make sense with the kind of things that are shown to us and to honor ourselves in this process. I mean, later on in our discussion, we'll kind of close up with Brandon's thoughts on how to actually live in a culture that is below the standards that we've set for ourselves, you know?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned being wrong, you know, and I think this returns to what we were originally talking about, where how does this fit into the philosophy of liberty and the pursuit of liberty in our lives and beyond? And I think we have to face the fact that a lot of us, and I wouldn't exclude myself from this group, might have been originally attracted to this philosophy, maybe the work of Rand or somebody like Rothbard, because we encounter the consistency of this and we say, great, I get to never be wrong again.
Yes.
Super.
At least in political debate, right?
Yeah, I'm so tired of being wrong. But balancing that with the integrity, like, it's more important to be consistent, to live with integrity, than to always be right. Like, life is always a learning experience. Mistakes, like we said in previous shows, can contain loads of valuable information.
Yes.
So learning more to embrace those mistakes. I talked about when I was, you know, started doing the show, and I don't know if you had a similar experience, but like the fear of, you know, double checking, triple checking, could anything possibly be wrong here? You know, is a fear that I overcame and realized that it created a more valuable learning experience for everybody. If people listened and disagreed and said, no, well, what about this? I mean, I learned that way too. So,
yeah.
You know, I just doing the best we can at every single point once we're aware of this idea of personal integrity, I think is what we should strive for.
Yeah. And wrong obviously has many definitions. The two prominent ones are, you know, incorrect. And another one is having to do with moralistic judgment. And it's unfortunate that that is a term that can be so problematic in our culture when it involves the moral issues. And from a nonviolent communication standpoint, we kind of want to go beyond the right doing and wrong doing thinking, because that leads to a disconnection from, you know, the cherished values, the needs that are going on, the motivating factors, if you will, that are driving people to develop these surface strategies, you know, to try to make sense of their behavior, make sense of our own behavior from the standpoint of our own standards. So, yeah, it's probably best not to use even the term wrong in the context of pointing out people's hypocrisy, because it's fine to use it. It's just that it's not fine for creating better connections within others and within oneself, because whenever you're told that you're wrong, immediately what's erected is a defense, you know, trying to protect oneself, trying to protect one's self-esteem. And one of the useful practices that Rosenberg offers in this regard that he instructs people to do is never to take what another person says or does personally. You'll live longer. That's the notion.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we can separate ourselves from what the person is saying in terms of saying we're wrong, that's another way to actually transcend it, because we can translate that wrong into saying that, oh, so they noticed that their need for consistency wasn't met, or my need for consistency wasn't met. How can we best meet this need now that it's been noticed? And now we're, you know, in a place where we can actually help ourselves rather than try to defend what we may not think is actually worth defending deep down, you know?
Yeah. You know, it also speaks to another value of nonviolent communication. Before you're even in that situation where you need to employ it with somebody else, you've asked yourself, why am I here? What do I want? What do I need? And maybe if you've done that, if I've done that, I'm less likely to use wrong as a label. And I've gotten a little bit better at the catch, you know, before something comes out of my mouth, where somebody else says something and I say, that's wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I don't say wrong. You know, I don't print out a label and stick it on, you know, their statement and then try to have some kind of constructive dialogue from there, because I know that doesn't work. You're right. It forces people to build these defenses.
Yeah, it reminds me that Julia Galef, I think she's at the Center for Applied Rationality over in the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
and she gave a talk, and she told a story about this older scientist that had been for years claiming a certain thing. I can't remember what it was. I think it had to do with the endoplasmic reticulum or something related to biology, cellular biology perhaps. And there was another researcher that gave a presentation that found evidence that refuted his lifelong theory about this. And apparently the guy came up to the stage, everybody's looking, because this guy was vociferously advocating his position, had been for decades, and they just kind of wanted to see how he's going to react to this. Well, he came up to the stage and shook the guy's hand and said, "Thank you. Now I can proceed with the truth, you know, with the correction here." So that was something that was really touching to Julia. She gave the presentation, because very often we don't see that in the realm of science, you know. There's a lot of people at loggerheads and a lot of debates that go on, argumentation and so forth. And oftentimes the self-esteem issues get mixed in with the search for truth, you know, the search for facts and trying to falsify beliefs and so forth.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more of this. We talked about this briefly before we started the show today. When something like science becomes politicized or, you know, tied to government, there's a lot of emotion and invective that gets injected into it.
Yeah.
And it starts to become, well, unscientific in many ways, especially when, you know, you start incorporating people's political or cognitive, I mean, political biases and cognitive biases line up nicely.
Mm.
But we're seeing a lot of that today, a lot of this trouble with science as scientism. There's a lot of people who really haven't done any legwork for themselves, but they're very worshipful of these sort of mainstream let's invest in X, Y, and Z, you know, through government scientists.
Mm-hmm.
But they become kind of religions in their own right. Dawkins, Tyson, Bill Nye. So, yeah, you want to speak on that for a few minutes?
Yeah, you know, I was up in Austin this last weekend, and there's a lot of South by Southwest stuff going on. And one of the things was a screening of Cosmos, Space Odyssey. And that's narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he was outside the theater giving an interview and so forth. And apparently that's become really commercialized, this whole sequel, or if it's a remake of Carl Sagan's thing. But yeah, you'll often find scientists that are really prominent that associate directly with political, quote, leaders, right? You mentioned that he was with Obama recently.
Well, Obama is the opening presentation or an opening monologue in this new Cosmos series.
Yikes.
So you see how these people have this popular appeal because science is cool right now, especially with young people who are more liberal because they see what the alternative is. People who use words like legitimate rape and talk about Noah's Ark and this caricature of anything else, basically. Like you're either, you know, you're down with global warming and government-funded science, or you're one of these sort of nitwit Southern kind of conservative caricatures.
Denier, you know, the global warming deniers.
Yes, so we remember the Holocaust for people who, you know, the Holocaust is brought up to label people who don't believe whatever they're told. And obviously there's a lot of questionable motives for not believing in global warming, you know, because I think there is obviously a lot of money put into anti-global warming arguments that comes from places like oil companies. And
sure.
That's just reality. That's just reality that people are vying for control of that debate. So it's troubling to see the president jumping in front of this, especially when you hear a lot of these people talk about how investing in science, which is a euphemism for more money to the government and putting the government in charge of more things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a number of fears that relate to that. But I really, as smart as these people are, Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, I kind of see them being used as pawns, getting people to accept this idea that science should be the domain of the government.
Yeah, and there's a sense that, oh, these guys aren't ever going to bite the hand that feeds them. And typically that's what I've seen with scientists. It's very hard for them to really come to terms with the nature of the funding that goes on, you know, and the more it is, you know, creating cognitive dissonance, the more rationalizations are erected. You know, because when you say, I don't want governmental funding of science, they're saying, you don't want progress in science, you know? It's just like, you know, when they say, who will build the roads, right? If you want to get government out of the road building business, which in fact they are, you know, they subcontract things out. And yeah, the issue of integrity just is involved in all these things, of course. It's just problematic when one is a scientist and has standards that haven't really been aligned with the truth. So if your standard is we need to fund science and then drop the context of how that funding actually happens, it's really hard to practice that personal integrity that Brandon is focused on, where you're really coming to terms with what's going on, the nature of the matrix, if you will, you know? And I've worked for companies, subcontractors, essentially private companies that have gotten contracts with local governments to put in pipeline projects. And that's been an issue with me as far as personal integrity too. Like, I do not want to support a system that is involved in coercion, you know? And yet we live in an economy where roughly half the population is employed in some form or fashion by government. So it's virtually inescapable. And I know Steph points out that really there's no way you can ascribe morality in a scenario where you've got a gun to your head in all different places in our society. But how to really distinguish what's going to be helpful for oneself versus going to be more damaging for oneself in the short run and the long run. I mean, I kind of drew the line psychologically when they took a contract to do a pipeline job on Camp Pendleton, which is a Marine Corps base north of San Diego. And I mean, I had to take a couple showers every time I went on that base. And we did like a couple months right. worth of work there. And it was like, just not a cool vibe at all, obviously, because this is an organization that is essentially destroying people's lives around the world. And it's all under this guise of, you know, this is saving us, protecting us, keeping the country secure, all this stuff. These sort of rationalizations are needed to perpetuate a system that is so blatantly unjust that any child that's actually informed of truthful matters in politics would recognize, you know. So how do we attune more to the sense of integrity that we all know deep down is necessary for fulfillment? I think that's really important. And Brandon gives an example here. He provides some endings to a really simple stem that he likes to use, different practices of self-esteem that he's mentioned and we've mentioned before, such as, if I bring 5% more integrity into my life, the answers by various clients were, I'd tell people when they do things that bother me. I wouldn't pad my expense account. I'd be truthful with my husband about what my clothes cost. I'd tell my parents I don't believe in God. I'd admit it when I'm flirting. I wouldn't be so ingratiating to people I dislike. I wouldn't laugh at jokes I think stupid or vulgar. I'd put in more of an effort at work. I'd help my wife more with chores, as I promised. I'd tell customers the truth about what they're buying. I wouldn't just say what people want to hear. I wouldn't sell my soul to be popular. I'd say no when I wanted to say no. I would acknowledge my responsibility to people I've hurt. I'd make amends. I'd keep my promises. I wouldn't pretend agreement. I wouldn't deny it when I'm angry. I'd make more of an effort to be fair and not just fly off the handle. I'd admit it when others have helped me. I'd admit it to my children when I know I'm wrong or incorrect. I wouldn't take supplies home from the office. The ease and speed of people's responses point to the fact that these matters are not very far beneath the surface of awareness, although there is an understandable motivation to evade them. One of the reasons I find sentence completion work so useful is its power to bypass most blocks and avoidances. A tragedy of many lives is that people greatly underestimate the self-esteem costs and consequences of hypocrisy and dishonesty. They imagine that at worst, all that is involved is some discomfort, but it is the spirit itself that is contaminated. And, you know, by spirit, he means mind, essentially, because he's an atheist.
Right. You know, when you were reading that list, it tied back to what we were talking about right before that as well, because what comes through in a lot of those statements is people recognizing this, again, something else we've already talked about, this compulsion to be perfect in the eyes of others, or to be more perfect in the eyes, or not more perfect, excuse me, better in the eyes of others, to appear better, right? So you talk about the experience of going onto this military base to do work, but the recognition that afterwards you need a shower,
yeah,
right? And I've had the same experience with some of the tutoring work that I used to do related to No Child Left Behind. I felt dirty, but I think that's such a better place to be, to realize that, yeah, in life, there's difficult choices and there's compromises and we're always trying to do our best. Then one thing that I've always found really upsetting when you're talking to somebody who is so rational in so many ways, but then all of a sudden they just run into a wall on one thing where all rationality goes out the window. And I'll tie it back to the science conversation that we were having. I still, from time to time, torture myself with Real Time with Bill Maher, the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, it's good for the gym because it really gets me, when your fists are clenched, that's a good time to maybe be doing something physical.
Get a good workout, yes.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So Bill Nye was on and he's talking about his debate with Ken Ham. And, you know, Bill Nye is being asked all these science questions and he's just doing what I thought was a really nice job providing clear answers. And then, you know, he kind of jumps into the, oh, we just will fund it, you know, or we'll invest in the future. But then the conversation turns to politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost embarrassed myself. It was a good thing the gym was empty because I said out loud, use the fucking scientific method, Bill. Kind of under my breath, but loud enough. If someone was right next to me, they would have heard me. And I guess really what I'm talking about here is empiricism, right? For
yes.
Somebody who talks about loving astronomy so much, check out empiricism. You might like that too, because he's talking about whoever was on the panel with him is like, yeah, voting doesn't matter. Voting is a waste of time. And he's like, no, you need to have more faith in the system. What? More faith
in the system.
What about, looking at evidence and making a conclusion.
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
Evidence gathered over a century.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the practice of living consciously, right? Acceptance of facts, looking at facts, raising awareness about facts rather than disregarding them or considering mm-hmm. some facts of lesser importance. And obviously, we need to prioritize our levels of knowledge of different things and kind of tip our hats to various people that have developed expertise in certain areas. But some of these basic philosophical issues, I think, are readily available to every human. It's just that we've not been taught or shown how to really think in this way of meeting our own need for understanding and for meaning and consistency as well. You know, this logical consistency that is pretty much necessary to really integrate reality for a conceptual consciousness. So to root your thinking in the facts of reality is a great place to start. And trying to falsify your beliefs if they don't seem to comport with the facts, or if someone argues against what your beliefs are, then the issue of integrity crops up. Like, I need to meet my need for consistency here, because if I'm not connected to reality in a non-contradictory way, then, you know, it may really make life much more difficult, obviously, if I'm believing falsehoods and asserting them as truths.
Yeah, even if you act as if, right? Goes back to only I will know.
Yeah.
It's a terrible place to be, you know?
It is.
And yeah, I mean, it's something that I've thought about too, where I say things that thousands of people can hear, and then sometimes questioning it and saying, well, you know, am I on board with that 100% in the thoughts and actions of everyday life? And, you know, I have to remind myself that what I've said a couple times already, these things don't have to be lived perfectly, but they have to be acknowledged, and they have to be practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have to be able to admit to ourselves when they're not, and obviously ask the question, the very important question, why? And explore this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we don't need to pile on in this way where one of the stems was, if I lived life with 5% more integrity. And I started thinking, well, what do we do when there seems to be so many consequences in the world
mm-hmm.
for living with integrity? Like, it could get you thrown in jail forever.
Yeah.
We've seen this with people you know in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, because we live in a power over dynamic, essentially. Like, if you don't do what you're told, then you're punished. I mean, that's the nature of statism. If government were in alignment with a respectful, integrated process of integrity that entailed restorative justice, they would, well, for one, have it going on a business sale, you know, because what they're doing is not really honoring the needs of other people. It's, I mean, piecemeal it is, but it's based on sort of this foundation of fear and distrust of self and others. So then now we've got to use force. Now it's the way of the barbarian as a way of life, and making that socially acceptable is the nature of the PR campaign. And this public relations is just, you know, it's a continual thing, pretty much. And it's really supported by the people that are not even in government too, like the intellectuals and so forth at universities, even though they get a large portion of their money from, you know, the government in terms of subsidies and student loans and grants and all that stuff. But I think it all speaks back to, you know, redeeming our minds from the hawk shops of authority, of not surrendering our minds to some higher power, be it a god, a government, or a parent even, you know. And I think a mm-hmm. lot of us in the maturation process, you know, part of this thing, Brandon calls it individuation, you know, basically developing your own sense of self and independence and your own sense of integrity in relation to what other people are doing and saying. And one of the sections here, he's got another stem because he's talking about how this appears for our lives in relation to our parents. You know, once we see that living up to our standards appears to be leading us towards self-destruction, the time has come to question our standards rather than simply resigning ourselves to living without integrity. We must summon the courage to challenge some of our deepest assumptions concerning what we have been taught to regard as the good. That courage may be needed is evident in the following sentence completions commonly heard in my therapy practice. Any psychotherapist who cares to experiment with these stems can discover for him or herself how typical these endings are. So, at the thought of going against my parents' values, I feel frightened. I feel lost. I see myself as an outcast. I no longer belong with my family. I feel alone. I'd have to think for myself. I'd have to rely on my own mind. What would I do then? I'd lose my parents' love. That whole love withdrawal thing that Alfie Cohn talks about, right? When you don't actually conform to the family system. I'd have to grow up. And the next stem. If I were to think for myself about the values I want to live by, mother would have a heart attack. I'd be free. I'd have to tell my parents I think they're wrong about a lot of things. Is this what grown-ups do? I'd need an awful lot of nerve. Wouldn't that be arrogant? I'd have to stand on my own feet. I couldn't be daddy's little girl anymore. And then he gives various examples of the confusion and conflict about what the practice of integrity might mean in daily living. And it's pretty interesting lineup there, huh? Most of it dealing with the religious stuff, huh?
Yeah, it's really it's very upsetting when you think about the consequences of living in a society where self-esteem isn't taught but irrational standards are.
Yeah.
Right? Because then people who have no understanding of, like, self-esteem is a word that's certainly used in school, and there might be a poster in the hall of your middle school with some stars on it that says, have self-esteem.
Yeah.
Right? But that's conforming to the irrational standards that people have just kind of accepted, and they've been passed along from generation to generation. And, you know, in school, we are the output. You know, we're not, it's like one of the things that I think is a recurring theme in the book is that the root of self-esteem is not accomplishment or output, but it's in these practices because it gives us a sense of control over ourselves and eventually maybe even approaching mastery of parts of self. But in school, none of that matters, right? The practices suck. The output is not exciting. The accomplishment is not, rewarding, but that's what we are, right? So you see how this translates into the irrational standards that are so easily embraced in society. Religious teachings is talked about. I think he says religious teachings that damn pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
The state has those. The culture has those, for sure. So we're learning plenty about the deepest assumptions of good.
Yes.
You know, not really invited that much, even though there's talk about it, you know, like question authority. There's, you know, slogans.
Slogans.
But people aren't really given, the encouragement or a way of practicing actually challenging the deepest assumptions of good. And even when people fall into that, what did he call it? He didn't call it mindless rebellion, or maybe he did.
Perhaps.
Something. Uh-huh. Yeah. They wind up falling into the same traps. Like, not all rebellion is good, even if the irrational standards of society and religion and culture are so egregious.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really a setup, isn't it? Because if we have these standards presented to us that are against our own lives and well-being, then it forces us, essentially, if we want to have self-esteem, to be in a hypocritical stance to those standards, to lack integrity towards irrational standards. And so that really messes with children's minds about the nature of integrity, doesn't it? Like, if integrity means conforming to perverse standards that you sense are in contrary to your nature, such as don't masturbate or no sexual pleasure, like he has a section here. He says, we may accept or absorb a code of values that does violence to our nature and needs. For example, certain religious teachings implicitly or explicitly damn sex, damn pleasure, damn the body, damn ambition. You know, the whole thing, people railing against the evil profits of businesses, right?
Right.
People are greedy and selfish. And they just want to make profits. It's those in government that are somehow not greedy and selfish, even though they're taking things through coercion rather than voluntarily, like business people do, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just a perverse set of circumstances. And he says, to resolve any of the conflicts listed above, or countless others like them, one would have to rethink one's deepest values, commitments, and priorities. Or perhaps think about them for the first time and be willing, if necessary, to challenge any and all authorities.
Something about what you just said makes me want to take back a word I used, which was egregious. because in your first couple sentences, you were talking about, you know, the social norm, what everyone is doing. Egregious is the wrong word to use to describe irrational standards. I'll call them offensive. You know, once we understand personal liberty and the pillars of self-esteem, egregious means out of the crowd, right? So egregious is a word that's usually used when something is offensive or off-putting. But what it means, if you look at its roots, Greg as a root means the crowd or the flock, you know, in words like congregate and segregate, and E means outside of. So
yeah.
Based on what you said, as I was listening to you talk, I said, egregious is the wrong word for irrational standards because that is the flock. So
yeah, and it's interesting how the terminology goes back to Latin here. Illustrious, literally standing out from the flock. Yeah, so that term itself is symbolic of what we're talking about because the first definition is outstandingly bad or shocking. And the archaic meaning is remarkably good. Isn't that interesting? So
yeah,
some of these terms are problematic, obviously. I actually skipped ahead a page when I read that second part, but it applies equally to what we were talking about in terms of religion, damning the body and the pleasures and so forth. And to wrap that one up, he said, essentially, we're damning the enjoyment of life on earth for all practical purposes. If children are indoctrinated with these teachings, what will the practice of, quote, integrity mean in their lives? Some elements of, quote, hypocrisy may be all that keeps them alive. And I remember Rand talking about the fact that, you know, with these really arbitrary and power over strategies, one needs to smuggle in, you know, a little bit of self-esteem or a little bit of selfishness in order to stay alive, essentially, because she saw these philosophies as philosophies of death, you know, not really honoring the life and well-being of individuals, but rather of collectives, of groups, of leaders, of authoritarian figures, you know, that wanted you to sacrifice for the sake of something else, you know, besides your own life and well-being. Or maybe that was part of the PR too, that this is actually good for you, little citizen.
Yeah, yeah. And the verdict, you know, socially, at least so far, on her urging was, that's outrageous. How could somebody be so inconsiderate? You know, I remember in one of our first conversations ever, 6 years ago, we were talking about the Fountainhead. And I remembered where I first saw the book. Long before I knew who Rand was, and I thought that was that's interesting. What's going on there? It was in a movie in 1987 called Dirty Dancing, and there's a waiter named Robbie who hands it to Baby to basically explain to her why he's such an asshole. He says, "Oh, you should read this. I've taken notes," and he hands her The Fountainhead. That was how I was introduced to the book. So, you know, the idea that she put forth that, you know, some, not just a sense of self, but a healthy and, Brandon in this book calls it an intelligent selfishness, is such an important counterbalance to what we are fed our whole lives. But it's so interesting to see how that idea, even that idea, was just kind of turned into a straw man and burned.
Yeah, yeah. There's that South Park episode too, right, with that one police character. Can't remember his name, but he was basically ranting about how he read Atlas Shrugged, and it was such a hugely long book that he basically has sworn off reading anything else since then. You ever see that clip?
No, I never have, actually.
Yeah, I'll see if I can dig it up. I saw it the other day, but yeah, it's like there are all kinds of things that can deter us from actually finding the truth in the matter, including, you know, the words of people that we admire and respect, in some respects at least. You know, Rand herself had all kinds of foibles that led to all kinds of contradictory assumptions or applications. Now, obviously, she was pretty much light years ahead of the culture in many respects about, you know, implementing the non-initiation of force principle across the board, and having a separation of state and economics, as she said, for the same reasons as you would have a separation of state and religion. Although we need to really separate ourselves from statism itself. You know, that's one of the main issues, because the services of justice, of restorative justice, in order to be truly effective, need to be provided for on a voluntary basis by individuals for individuals. And any other system that's set up, any other arrangement, is by definition contradictory, because individuals are the ones that are going to be benefiting from behavior that they bring to the marketplace based on people being willing to pay for them. I mean, it speaks to the integrity in the realm of science too. If you believe as a scientist that you cannot pursue your desires without tax money, it's essentially saying that, and you'll hear scientists actually say this, that nobody would really pay for the research that's so necessary in order for innovation to happen, you know? But is that true if you've never given it a chance? You know, if you abolish the tax system entirely, what would actually happen in the realm of science? I think there'd be a huge amount of scientific innovation and progress, because now the funding is not going into mouse studies anymore and different FDA protocols that may or may not be helpful, but rather what people in the marketplace want from people doing science. And you know, maybe their pay structure would change, maybe a lot of different things, the channels of funding would change quite a bit, but you know, in the long run, everyone is going to benefit way more through that paradigm, because it is one that is win-win, and it's not based on any contradictory assumptions about human beings that somehow they're not wanting the benefits of science, and we need to force them to show them that they're going to get these benefits whether they like them or not, because they're so necessary.
You're right, though, just to make these, they're not really even predictions, because they're more just like things people say. Like, a prediction sounds more scientific than it is. Oh, people would never fund that. People would never be interested in something like that. Well, you're only able to apply the lessons of this world, where no one has the money or the personal empowerment or the freedom to participate in something like that. You know, because what we learned our whole life, that, you know, the state does those things, or the experts do those things. And that's not us. That's not most of us. So we feel, I think there's a great comfort for a lot of us in deferring to somebody else. You know, and there's places where we have to, but we should think about who it is and why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. First. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's something that we're really encouraged to do that much, unfortunately.
No, we're really encouraged to surrender to various systems, various belief systems, you know, to not rock the mm-hmm. boat, not go against the grain, to not make lives more difficult for ourselves, I guess. Because I'll give you another personal example. I was looking to go into brain research, a PhD program in, you know, cognitive neuroscience or computational neurobiology. And I did some research about it and discovered that I really couldn't find a program that didn't take at least half their money from the federal government in doing this research. So I knew that at least 50% of the time we're doing stuff that probably wouldn't be done in a free marketplace. Or if it were in a free marketplace, voluntary funds coming in, it would be done in a different fashion than the one that's set up with the governmental purse strings, you know? So mm-hmm. for my sense of personal integrity, I did not go into that realm. But I look forward to doing that whenever we get a free marketplace, you know. I actually look forward to getting involved in anti-aging research, and there is an example that is probably more in line with personal integrity, because it relies on private funding for the most part, like Aubrey de Grey's SENS.org, Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence, because if life is a standard of value, it really helps to have the longest life imaginable, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
As long as one is healthy, that's the key, to use these rejuvenation technologies that we can ensure our lives indefinitely, if it's at all possible. I think we're at a pivotal moment in human history now. This century is going to be one where we either make or break our species, essentially. And if we make it,
yeah,
we're going to have an extraordinary future ahead of us beyond all, well, actually, the imagination about this is hard to even grapple with, because we just don't know what we don't know. You know, these technologies, there's references to the technological singularity as being this point at which all bets are off. You really can't make any predictions, because everything is accelerating at such a rate of innovation that you just can't predict it and how it goes. So those kinds of things, you know, all play a part in trying to find out what is the optimal way to proceed in our society today. And I think one of the main takeaways, I guess, for personal integrity in a status marketplace is, are you able to speak your mind at least to the people that you're doing business with, or the people that you're interacting with, to basically state what you've come to as far as conclusions that are going to be the most helpful for everyone. To know that perhaps, well, currently it's done like this, but it could be a lot better if it were done like this, and not at the sacrifice of all these different things that we've been talking about. And the more people have their awareness raised on that, the more likely it is that they can eventually change their minds and their behaviors about how they're proceeding presently, and develop a sense of higher integrity with this.
Yeah, but what's usually attached to that kind of thinking is, it has its consequences, as we already mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're rocking the boat, you know, or you're making things uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That could be in a variety of different ways where, you know, people do what feels comfortable, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that's normal. I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of, but...
No, we're trying to meet some needs, you know, needs, connection needs going on there for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. And one of the great challenges is, like, life is hard and fast enough. You know, you want me to think about how to privately fund science, you know,
exactly.
Well, I've got two kids. You know, the foundation is missing, right? When life feels like just pure chaos, mm-hmm. going and holding signs in the center of town, or trying to get some radical person elected to an office, really, I think, is just, generally speaking, contributing to other people's stress level, you know, increasing it, right? Because so many personal foundations are kind of shaky. And I don't want to take, you know, I'm not trying to psychologize the entire population, but we see plenty of evidence for this. Mm. I don't think I'm, you know, speaking out of turn by saying that.
No, it's no secret that people tend to feel uncomfortable when you raise issues that are contrary to their own behaviors, for instance, you know, that speak to the issue of personal integrity. And I think that just shows how much of a value it is, or virtue, or just basic need for consistency, and honesty and authenticity. I think those are really prevalent needs that oftentimes people lose sight of amidst all the systems that they're surrendering to, or they're sacrificing to. Like, there is this premise that we need to sacrifice to the system. Why? Because that's what's required. Why? Because that's what we've always done, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That being said, let's talk about a word that is mentioned in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But as I read this, I thought a lot. And the word is guilt.
Yeah.
Okay? And there's different ways we can come to experience guilt. The first is the one you just described, where we're not conforming to irrational standards. But if we're not conforming without this philosophy as our foundation, you know, like when we're teenagers and we're just like, well, that's stupid, I'm not going to do that, and hopefully I'll get away with it.
Yeah.
And then we get caught and someone says, look how bad you are. Well, we might walk away from a lot of those situations, especially if we're younger than teenagers and we do that and we get caught, with these tremendous feelings of guilt. So we've talked about overcoming that by helping people understand the true nature of school, society, culture, government, religion, of course. Another type would be a more personal guilt, right? Where it starts with the deceptive phrase that we talked about a couple times, only I will know. But then we start to see the incongruence between what we profess and how we behave. And that can lead to feelings of guilt. And I think we talked about how to overcome that as well. But then there's a third type where we've actually wronged somebody, you know, or we've actually had another interaction with somebody else, and the other person left that interaction or that relationship hurt.
Yeah.
And that's not a completely synthetic guilt, right? It's not society made. It's a real bad feeling that we have to grapple with.
Yeah.
So that was something that I wanted to talk a little bit about here. He has a list of, you know, living with this and dealing with this and overcoming this.
Yeah. And just to preface that, I would say that he's kind of offering a view that is in alignment with nonviolent communication as well, because nonviolent communication offers this this really insightful, really helpful, really rejuvenating restorative justice process. And it's not so much about the guilt as it is just regret, a feeling of regret that one didn't meet these particular needs, say a need to respect others, which boils back to a need of respecting oneself. So he says the protection of self-esteem requires a clear understanding of the limits of personal responsibility. Where there is no power, there can be no responsibility. And where there is no responsibility, there can be no reasonable self-reproach. Regret, yes. Guilt, no. So actually, I'm mistaken. He's actually aligning more with the domination culture that we need to reproach ourselves if we've done something that we could have done otherwise, should have done otherwise. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, but I saw it like what he goes through and he says is, you know, when somebody else has been hurt by our actions or, you know, our lack of actions or our words or, you know, variety of different circumstances, the first thing to do is face and accept the full reality of the situation without disowning ourselves or avoidance, then to seek to understand why we did what we did. So from what I'm reading, you know, this is not total domination culture kind of thinking. The next one is acknowledge to others the harm we've done and to convey an understanding of the consequences. Number four, to take restorative action. And number five, firmly commit to behaving differently in the future.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier to do number five, obviously, if the first four are underneath it or happened before it. Because the easiest, I mean, it's so easy to say, well, I won't do that again. You know, that's a very easy thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah, in a sense, to lie to ourselves. Because we haven't really done the restorative work to really get in touch with those needs that weren't met as a consequence. And not to reproach ourselves. I mean, he talks about reasonable self-reproach, but I don't think self-reproach or condemnation, and I don't think he really believes that in the long run it is helpful as an overarching philosophy, because he really went against, stood opposed to Rand's objectivism in that regard, the moral condemnation. You know, she used the word evil with a frequency of the high priest of the Middle Ages. I think one of his quips was about that, saying that he was really disappointed that they were so focused on moralistic judgment and condemning people, because, again, that doesn't really offer a path for redemption or a path to restore, you know. So it speaks to that second one. We seek to understand why we did what we did. We do this compassionately, as discussed under the practice of self-acceptance, but without evasive alibiing. And I think that evasive alibiing speaks to, again, our sense of integrity, that we're trying to conform to standards that may or may not be constructed by ourselves to avoid punishment, perhaps, you know. But if we get into this realm of compassion for ourselves, for our behaviors, for our mistakes, then we can look at the reasons why we took the action we did. You know, if we know things now that we didn't know back then, if we had this present knowledge back in the past, then we would have made a different choice, obviously. But the fact that we made that particular choice was based on the knowledge that we had right then and there, and the knowledge of the strategies. Like, maybe this strategy was just seen as the only one to meet this particular need, and we had a real narrow focus, and we lost sight of these other needs and these other potential strategies to meet those needs and also meet the one they were trying to meet. So I think it's about expanding awareness and increasing the possibilities for understanding why we did what we did in a compassionate way.
It's so liberating too. I mean, to recognize this in ourselves and in other people, because if we don't, you know, these things that we've been discussing, if we don't recognize them, then all we're really left with when most of these things happen is fight or flight.
Yeah.
You know, what I've been so critical of other people doing when I bring up religion or school or politics or whatever, right? Then if we can't go through those steps and if we can't have those realizations, we're just left with fight or flight, right? Which is, the fight would be, oh, well, I didn't do anything wrong. The other person did this, this, and this. Or the flight, the avoidance, and the disowning of self, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in a, you know, you, we talked about the objectivists and their moralizing, and it would have been interesting to see what was different. I mean, maybe Brandon is somewhat of a representation of that. If they had recognized the liberating power of, you know, understanding the fallibility of, you know, first of all, if we're talking about Rand herself, you know, and the people who are close to her and the people she disagreed with. It's an interesting question, unfortunately, probably unanswerable. How different would the embrace of that philosophy have been, you know, in a widespread kind of way?
Yeah, absolutely. If Rand had focused on compassion and this idea that we are fallible, I mean, she acknowledged that, obviously. And she has a phrase through the words of John Galt, you know, like accepting one falsehood on your own is better than accepting 10 supposed truths by others, I guess, you know, because when you rely on your own judgment and understanding discernment, then you can rectify the mistakes. But if you just blindly accept or have that faith, right, and don't check what the others are saying, then we can really go off the rails in terms of, I mean, our need for understanding and authenticity and honesty about all these things. So, yeah, I think compassion is a huge component for keeping aligned with our sense of integrity, because obviously, because of people's behaviors, the defenses and the rationalizations and evasions and all those things that come up from doing things that we're not so proud of, it shows just how valuable it is to have a consistent sense of self, to be really integrated, have that congruence between what we profess and what we believe. And it makes it doubly difficult, triply, quadruply difficult in a culture that has such non-objective standards, such standards that do damage to our own sense of personal integrity from an individualistic perspective, you know, from an autonomous perspective, because we are beings that need autonomy and choice and freedom as much as we need connection and, you know, belonging and inclusion and closeness, you know. He has a couple of stems here I think are pretty instructive, such as, if I think about the areas where I find it difficult to practice full integrity, a lot of things can come up in that process.
Yeah, definitely a lot of information there, right?
Yeah.
Because if we identify those areas, we've probably had some, maybe what we would call mistakes in those realms, right?
Yes.
And exploring that, asking that question, why, could certainly produce some valuable information.
Yeah, to realize that there might have been this cover-up process for ourselves, somehow thinking that if we don't address where it's difficult to practice full integrity, then somehow something's going to work out. But as we bring more awareness to it, like his next one, if I bring a higher level of consciousness to the areas where I find it difficult to practice full integrity, then it makes it harder to avoid them. You know, then I can really recognize them for what they are. Then I can start the process of healing, perhaps. Then I can, you know, make amends with myself for, you know, ascribing guilt. That's another thing about the guilt. Nonviolent communication kind of lumps that emotion in with anger and shame and blame. It's really sort of a domination way of thinking about our feelings, because it really, you know, speaks to having done something wrong and being bad as a person, like being this label, this category, and that becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we can look at the needs or the feelings, especially underneath the guilt, which is, you know, remorse and sadness and a sense of regret, you know, and then connect those to the needs that weren't met. I know in the restorative justice process, there is the connection to those needs to respect others.
Yeah.
Need for that sense of consistency and personal integrity. Because obviously, if we violate the rights of others, then we can't apply that just in a one-way direction if we hold it as a standard, that it's okay to violate the rights of others. I guess, you know, you could see our society today as this multiple violations of everyone's rights as a way of life, essentially. And trying to uphold this standard as somehow viable for society. There's the guy Richard Nicolai. We interviewed him for Healthy Mind, Fit Body. He's got a site called freetheanimal.com, and he's pretty outspoken about the memes of statism being so damaging. He's got a quite jackalish way of characterizing it, shall we say. And it can be humorous at times too. But I think you mentioned once in a blog post that what we have now is cannibal pot hysteria, you know?
Cannibal pot hysteria.
Yeah. Everyone gets thrown in the pot and we get cannibalized in this hysterical fashion, you know? So we're all feeding off of each other in the memes of statism because it's power over, it's domination oriented, it's punishing people. It is not treating human beings as respectful, reasoning creatures, you know, right off the bat, essentially. We're taught that we're supposed to obey or we're going to get punished. You know, that is not respecting each person for the conceptual creature that they are, able to figure things out, you know. And if we apply this to ourselves, if we're somehow, you know, the punisher and the person that gets punished, then, you know, we're just living in a morass of contradictions. And it takes a heroic sort of gesture of awareness to really realize that this is not the path for living the good life. You know, Brandon has this section at the end, keeping your integrity in a corrupt world. In a world where we regard ourselves and are regarded by others as accountable for our actions, the practice of integrity is relatively easier than in a world where the principle of personal accountability is absent. A culture of accountability tends to support our moral aspirations. If we live in a society where business associates, corporate heads, political figures, religious leaders, and other public personalities hold themselves to higher standards of morality, it is relatively easier for an average person to practice integrity than in a society where corruption, cynicism, and amorality are the norm. So obviously, I think we take issue with his statement there, because he's assuming that in a free society, we would have corporate heads, political figures, religious leaders, and so on, you know?
Yeah, it sounds strange to me.
Yeah, that's the sort of conservative vein of objectivism that seems to permeate across, you know, the spectrum of objectivists, it seems.
Yeah, there's a danger implied in there as well. He talks about this challenge of having high personal standards while feeling like we're living in a moral sewer.
Yes.
Right? And I think this is something that a lot of us, if we've been immersed in the liberty movement or the philosophy of liberty or objectivism or even libertarian politics for a while, this is a very nice and comfortable feeling.
Yeah.
You know? Well, like, thank goodness for me. Thank goodness I'm here.
And he says, you know, grounds for such a feeling are to be found in the behavior of our public figures, the horror of world events, and in our so-called art and entertainment, so much of which celebrates depravity, cruelty, and mindless violence.
And we have to do the world criticism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, what did I call it? Libertarian world criticism. Where I was looking at Facebook yesterday, and, you know, I have a lot of friends, and it wasn't the majority of them, but I'm like, am I really supposed to be mad about daylight savings time? Like, I'm just going to take today off from being mad, you know? I'm going to try. But people are, like, posting, like, angry posts about daylight savings time.
Yikes.
You know? Yeah, I understand. It's terribly stupid, but I didn't devote much thought to it. And like I said, it was just a few people, but it seemed to have more weight and volume.
Yeah.
As negativity does in the news feed. And I only point out what I saw from these people in a critical way, because I totally know the feeling of walking into a room of friends, you know, who aren't familiar with all the stuff that we talk about, or family members, and there's this kind of feeling that comes over the environment, like, here comes Brett to ruin whatever we're talking about.
What's he going
to
say now?
Right? Or showing up with note cards when it's the 4th of July or Easter or Christmas or
Listen
Veterans
up, people.
Day. Memorial Day. Yeah. Labor Day. I'll ruin them all.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So that kind of feeling also leads to a real lack of empathy, right? Where we're canoeing through a swamp.
Exactly. With lots of brown trout floating around.
In a white suit.
Uh-huh.
Canoeing through the swamp.
Yes. And each time you paddle, it splatters a little bit more on you, and you get more irritated as you go along and depressed.
Exactly.
And pretty soon your boat is actually filling up with this stuff because you got a hole in the bottom. So you got to sit there and spend a lifetime trying to build it out so you can stay afloat. And that is not a comfortable place to be by any stretch, is it?
No, absolutely not. And he reinforces this very idea that we're talking about by calling it lonely, which it certainly doesn't have to be, especially if you, he wrote the book when a lot of the pathways for connection that we have today didn't exist or weren't nearly as well developed.
Yeah,
and he also calls it heroic,
yes.
Which maybe someday other people will look back and apply that label to many of us, all of us. I don't think it's a bad thing to acknowledge in ourselves at all. But as long as it isn't messing with our ability to understand and empathize with other people.
Yeah, which begins with understanding and empathizing with ourselves. So
mm-hmm.
if there's that thought that we're living in a moral sewer, how is that constituted? Because that, if you look at the cognitive distortions, right, which one would that be? Catastrophizing, perhaps? All or none thinking? I mean, there's some things going on there that aren't quite aligning with the evidence, because you can step out your door and not see much of the sewage, Depends on where you live, depends on who you talk to. And so we can select places to go, people to see, things to do that have nothing to do with that sort of despair scenario that arises from, so much that needs to be changed in the culture for people's needs to get met and for sacrifice not to be a constant theme in various systems. So outside those systems, we can find a lot of enjoyment, a lot of enrichment, and even on our own, just going on a camping trip or something. I mean, that is part of the world just as much as this world that he's describing as a moral sewer. Because it's like when people say, they tell kids, life is not fair, kids, right? Well, actually, life is just as it is. It's indifferent to us living or dying, having pleasure mm-hmm. or living in despair. It's people. Fairness is a concept just like justice from a conceptual creature known as human beings, Homo sapiens. And so what does that pertain to, the fairness or unfairness? Because it's often said in the context of like school, life isn't fair. You got to do your homework, right? You got to do this, that, and the other. But does that really accord with the facts? Is that something that is actually truthful? Or is it something that right. someone is saying in order to get you to do something, or to do something that's contrary to your own interests? Like, are you able to do what you want
right.
to do when you want to do it? And I guess when you aren't, then that idea of unfairness happens.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what an honest conversation based on those ideas would actually look like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This is just what we say when we encounter resistance at this point.
Yeah. And to get back to your idea, the Facebook thing, expression of all the outrage about the time change, I'm guessing that their need for consistency, and for their own peace of mind, it's those needs aren't really getting met, not getting fulfilled in this arbitrary change in the time at an arbitrary point in time by a top-down authority. It's like that is irritating, like to think that, hey, it was 9 o'clock, but now it's 10 because somebody else said so, and I've got to adjust myself to that. Like that immediately generates an autonomy war, doesn't it? No, we like to standardize things for business, commerce, and interacting with people. So it'd be nice if we just had a set time. I mean, some places like Arizona don't even have the time change. So maybe that's preferable.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm empathizing more with them already. I was up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I looked at the clock and I was like, damn, it's late. I got to get to bed. And then all of a sudden it changed to 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, shit, now I just lost an hour. And that was a little frustrating. And I think that, it also shows that, I mean, maybe some people do it just because it's the complaint du jour, but maybe some people really respect their time and their schedules and their routines.
Mm-hmm.
And it is disruptive. It's definitely disruptive. I'm happy we have more daylight here in the frozen tundra, but there's more to think about there. I can understand, obviously, why it upsets people. I look forward to being in Arizona next week, by the way.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice sunny weather, I'm sure.
So as we wrap up the six pillars, he mentioned something at the end of this chapter called the principle of reciprocal causation. And he talks about how in many of his therapy groups, he's been met with this objection that, well, to do these things, a person would need to have self-esteem already. Because I think a lot of us can identify with just that, oh, the hell with it, you know, or even if we are more aware of maybe some of the things we'd like to do better or some of the practices we'd like to have, there's always Monday. You know, there's always next Monday
when
we can start them.
Exactly.
You know, there's always tomorrow. But that's a fair criticism that, you know, to do these practices, it seems like there would need to be a certain self-esteem bedrock already existing. And what he says is that the behaviors that generate self-esteem are also expressions of self-esteem. So as we go back through all of the pillars, we're talking about doing all of these things better, but I would say a lot of it is the compulsion of a human being to be aware of these six things. And even though at different times in life where, you know, we only have so much effort available to devote to each practice, to each pillar, these are things that we're aware of, and these are things that we're striving for, regardless of what kind of trouble we might find ourselves in.
Yeah, reciprocal causation. I like this paragraph. He says, another noteworthy aspect of the dynamics involved here is that the practice of these virtues over time tends to generate a felt need for them. If I habitually operate at a high level of consciousness, unclarity and fog in my awareness will make me uncomfortable. I will usually experience a drive to dispel the darkness. If I have made self-responsibility second nature, passivity and dependency will be onerous to me. I will experience internal pressure to reassert the control over my existence, possible only with autonomy. If I have been consistent in my integrity, I will experience dishonesty on my part as disturbing, and will feel a thrust to resolve the dissonance and restore the inner sense of moral cleanliness. Now, we may take issue with the idea of moral cleanliness because that speaks to, you know, Puritanism, right?
Mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
any kind of religious notion of moral purity. But I think what he's getting at is, I've really nourished my own need for honesty by really attending to the feeling of disturbance, perhaps, or unease when I didn't say something that was in accordance with the facts, for instance.
Mm-hmm. And these things might seem like work at first, right? But understanding what these practices are and then practicing them the best we can from wherever we are, doing that will generate a need for their presence in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Same is true with exercise, right? The first day of exercise is very shitty for all of us, you know, if we've never done it before or we've been off for a long time. But from doing practice, it's a kind of work that you don't mind. Or it's a kind of, even if it's not work, it's a kind of awareness that you don't mind. Like with nutrition, you know, I first thought about giving up bread or cheese or Diet Coke, you know, those were hard times. But over time, that practice generated a need for the continuance of that in life.
Like that need was more pressing. It became in the foreground as opposed to in the background. Because on my show, Complete Liberty Podcast, I've talked about my dismay and disappointment that more NVC trainers, for instance, don't emphasize the needs for autonomy and freedom and choice and respect in relation to the domination system of government. Like there isn't a focus on that as a power over system that doesn't need to be there. And I think it's because it's probably an overwhelming thing to contemplate, and it can be overwhelming to devise strategies by which to crack that nut, so to speak.
Right.
So it's best left unsaid or undone, and just work within the system kind of thing. And we do see quite a bit of that happening. And I guess maybe there's this hope that if you work enough in the system, then the mentalities that are driving it today, supporting that belief system, will change over time as well. They become transformed. But if everyone's still operating in accordance with the rules of the system, you know, like you could probably work with police to make them the most benevolent police force around and deal with any kind of altercation with a really compassionate mindset. But the system itself over time will erode, will work against that, because the system is about power over. I mean, these people are authorized to kill you if you resist them. And if you try to defend yourself, you'll be, you know, extinguished as well. So when we're operating in a context that is at odds with our ability to meet various needs, then that's the time where we need to question that system itself and ask what its utility actually is. Because, man, it's so easy to just conform to systems, isn't it, as we know? And to go counter to that, to actually question the nature of how things are going and offer alternatives that are actually doable, I think is really helpful too. But this reciprocal causation, I think, it actually drives more of this nourishment. It's all about being kind to yourself, all these practices of self-esteem, doing kind things for yourself, which leads, by extension, doing kind things for other people. Because the more you value yourself, the more you're going to see that other people need to value themselves, right? And you respect that valuation process, you know? So self-esteem is a very, very important need that becomes really pressing the more we focus on it and realize all the dynamics and all the things that are impinging upon it in the culture and in our social relationships, you know?
Yeah, and that also relates to the idea that the less chaos we live in personally, the more we're able to notice that other people are there.
Indeed, yes. We've raised our consciousness about what people are attending to, what I'm attending to, and be an example of what to attend to as really healthy and compassionate and kind and enjoyable, you know? Don't forget the fun factor, because this is ultimately something that should bring that nourishment in that way, that pleasure.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not so much about value hedonism as it is about just valuing your worth, your worthiness for happiness, and your confidence in your ability to cope with life's challenges. Because once you have been able to do that, it becomes this sort of inertia. This, you've already gotten the momentum going. And it's just a little bit hard to get the momentum going at first, obviously, because of all these factors we've talked about, all these systems that are really, you know, weighing us down. But if we can free ourselves from some of those systems here and there and seek out places and people that aren't so involved in them, that can give us more power to get that momentum going and keep that inertia so that we can keep on with these practices as we go through life.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good place to wrap up, finally, with that notion about living in bliss, you know, the Joseph Campbell statement about follow your bliss. And he would add some caveats to that, but he'd reduce it down to a single sentence: live consciously, take responsibility for your choices and actions, respect the rights of others, and follow your own bliss.
When all those other things are done first.
Exactly. Yeah. And take what you want, said God, and pay for it. The Spanish proverb he likes. So that's that win-win trade process, to get what we want in life, to trade value for value and enrich each other's lives.
Right. I think that's complete.
Excellent. Thanks, Brett.
It's my pleasure, Wes. Thank you so much for devoting all this time to helping me and my audience get a better understanding of this material. It's so important. If anything, I wish we hadn't waited so long.
Yeah.
To delve into this subject, you know, around episode 260. It's a good place to start.
Yeah, no better time than the present, right?
Hey, that's really true, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all we live in. And I think in this book, he mentions a seventh pillar somewhere towards the end. So we will definitely get into that one. And, you know, none of these are set in stone, just like the commandments, right? There used to be 15 or 20, according to that one movie where he drops a couple of tablets.
Mel
he says,
Brooks.
Oh, 10 commandments. That's what I have for you.
Yeah.
But these are the farthest thing from commandments, because that would be contradictory as well. Like having sort of demands upon us rather than useful instructions about how to really increase our ability to experience bliss.